first part of the talk, I'd just like to introduce you to Super Brownian Motion, just try to explain what it is. And then I'd like to focus in particular on its role as a universal scaling limit for spatially distributed stochastic systems at criticality. And I hope there'll be time to discuss a broader class of processes which arise as solutions to a class of stochastic partial differential equations which behave locally like a superprocess. So start with discussing the universality property of ordinary Brownian motion. So you take a particle moving in an integer lattice, and it starts at the origin. In each unit time, it selects a neighbor at random and moves there independently. So wi is your ith step, then your position at time n is just the sum of all these independent random quantities. And we want to look at this random walk on the lattice from afar, so we're going to scale down space by 1 over root n, and then speed up time so that you see something, and that would be like a factor of n. And we get this rescaled random walk moving in the rescaled lattice. And the classical central limit theorem says if you observe this rescaled random walk at a fixed time, say time 1, then the probability distribution of that random location will converge to this normal distribution. So there's a parameter d here coming from the mean square displacement of each component of the wi. That's 1 over d. And about 50 years ago, Munro Donsker answered a question of Joe Doob and pointed out that you could, in fact, look at the entire history of this rescaled random walk. So you look at the entire evolution. That gives you a probability measure on function space. And that probability measure converges to a limiting probability, which is supported on continuous paths. And that can serve as our definition of Brownian motion. And there's, again, a scaling factor coming from the standard deviation of the wi coordinates. So the universality of Brownian motion reflects the fact that this is a very robust theorem. And if you replace those nearest neighbor steps with any sequence of independent repeated random quantities, as long as those quantities are zero on average with finite second moments, so say a covariance matrix multiple of the identity, then in Donsker's theorem, say, you get the exact same limit, except you have a different parameter here, sigma in front of the Brownian motion. So the microscopic information in the steps only persists in the limit through the single scalar quantity. And the whole field of invariance principles in the 50s and 60s and 70s was built extending this basic theorem to classes of stationary processes, weakly dependent processes, martingales. So there's a whole slew of theorems which say under fairly minimal conditions you get Brownian motion as the limit. And a particular extension that we may use from time to time is that instead of branching at multiples of 1 over n, we could branch at random times. And it's convenient to say that we branch at rate n. That will mean that the interjump times are independent exponentials with mean 1 over n. So you're still on average taking a step every 1 over n. Okay, so the universality of Brownian motion, I've led it to be used to model a number of different stochastic phenomena. Brown originally observed a particle in a viscous liquid undergoing molecular bombardment, and it was proposed by Bachelier in his thesis as a model for stock market fluctuations. And Kiyoshi Ito used it as a fundamental tool in his theory of stochastic integral equations, which allowed him to construct muralistic models for these and other phenomena. So it's a basic tool in modern probability. And so one thing we sometimes discuss with our students is why does the normal distribution arise? Well, if you have a scaling limit theorem like this, that will force certain scaling properties on the limiting object. So if Z just denotes your limit here in the central limit theorem without any preconceived notion of what it is, and we look at the random walk up to time t1 plus t2, the rescaled random walk, and split it up into the first time t1 and the second increment of length t2, and just gather together variables, you'll see that these increments are essentially independent of this quantity. And if we just let n go to infinity in this simple equation, this quantity here will, of course, go to this random variable z1. This quantity here will go to an independent copy of the same distribution by the universal limit theorem. And so you get this very simple scaling relationship that this limiting distribution must satisfy, where z1 and z2 are independent copies of z. And so if you do a bit of Fourier analysis on this, you'll find that the only distributions which satisfy this are the mean zero Gaussian distributions. Okay. So in super Brownian motion, the idea is, instead of looking at the random evolution of a single particle, we look at the random evolution of an entire random distribution of mass, which is undergoing branching and migration. So you have a couple of parameters, a branching rate b and a diffusion rate sigma squared. In addition, you can introduce a growth parameter so you can model slightly subcritical or supercritical systems. You start a large number of particles distributed in Euclidean space. And then with rate bn, so after an exponential time with mean 1 over bn, a particle will die. And with rate almost the same, a slightly perturbed rate, a particle will produce an offspring at a slightly displaced location. So the scaling of the location is the random walk, is the same scaling as a random walk. So if we were to look down the ancestral lineages of the motion of a particle, it's taking steps at rate n, steps of size w over root n. So this is the Brownian type scaling. And the other scaling we've introduced here is the fact that the number of particles is the same order as the rate at which you're speeding up time, which may not be clear why that's the case. We'll come back to that in a minute. So that gives you an ensemble of particles, and you record the state of that ensemble of particles in terms of an empirical measure. So you just put mass 1 over n at each site, and that gives you a random measure in RD. And Shinzo Watanabe showed that if the initial configuration of particles converge to some limiting distribution, some limiting measure x0, and you look at the random probability, so this now is a probability measure on the space of measure-valued paths, that those probabilities will converge to a limiting probability supported by the continuous measure-valued paths. And this process is a nice Markov process. Its law depends only on these parameters, and that's the definition of super Brownian motion. So it's the scaling limit of a critical or near-critical branching random walk. And again, you can do a number of different things. You don't have to be tied. You can, of course, do discrete time branching. So every 1 over n, an individual could be replaced by a random number of offspring. It doesn't have to be binary branching. It could be any number of offspring with mean 0, with mean 1, or mean asymptotically 1, and finite variance, and you'll get exactly the same limit. And more generally, you can migrate according to virtually any stochastic process you want, and the branching can be certain infinite variance branching mechanisms, and then you can get a more general class of what are called Dawson-Watanabe superprocesses. Okay, so just to get a feel for what this looks like, so here's a schematic picture of a super Brownian motion. So here at time zero, we've got the initial population, big O of n particles lined up. And what we're doing is we're just tracing the family trees of the descendants of each one of those particles. And the independence embedded in the model means that these family trees evolve independently. So that results in a decomposition. If we look at the measure, the random measure at time t, we can write that as a sum of independent pieces according to these clusters. And in fact, there's going to be big O of n, some n's here, but most of them aren't going to contribute. Kolmogorov showed that if you're in a critical Galton-Watson branching process, and so let's set g equal to 0 for this discussion, then the probability of being alive after n generations is inversely proportional to n. So at time t, we're branching with rate n times b, so there's roughly ntb generations between time 0 and time t. So the probability that one of these clusters is contributing is 1 over ntb. So it's very small. And so it's clear why you need n initial or order n initial particles in order to get a non-trivial limit at this time. Moreover, the actual number of clusters contributing will be a binomial distribution where we have this many trials and this probability of success. So there's a classical approximation of probability, the Poisson approximation to the binomial, which says in the limit as n goes to infinity, the number of non-zero sumands will be Poisson, and the mean of the Poisson will just be this number times this number. So if you let n go to infinity in this decomposition, you get a decomposition of a super Brownian motion into a Poisson number of independent clusters. So given that the sum converges and the number of terms converging, it's not hard to use some Fourier analysis to see that these clusters are also going to be converging. So they're in some sense the basic building block of super Brownian motion are these independent clusters corresponding to distinct ancestors. And the other thing to note is that because t is small, you get a large number of clusters contributing. And when t is large, of course, you get asymptotically zero clusters contributing. So with very high probability for large t, you're extinct. So this process as described here becomes extinct in finite time. Okay, so here are some pictures of Ackham-Klinker. Well, these are pictures not of Ackham, but by Ackham. And so there's 40,000 particles. There's 250 colors. They're moving on the torus. They're doing nearest neighbor dynamics as far as diffusion is concerned, so sigma squared is a half. And what happens is fairly quickly you get clustering. Okay, it's reflecting the fact that a lot of the ancestral lineages are dying out. So the colors, obviously, green particles give birth to green particles. The clusters are there just so you can distinguish ancestral lines. Okay, so there's a lot of space opening up, and we'll see in a minute that, in fact, what we're looking at is supposedly a Lebesgue null set. So here, you know, the blue ancestors look like they're on thin ice, and the green, well, doesn't look too healthy, but green makes a comeback, and blue is gone. So there's four colors here, and with very high probability, we can be sure that they come from four distinct ancestors. So the entire population is descended from four distinct ancestors, and in fact, the actual number of ancestors at this time is Poisson with mean 3.6. Okay, so let's say a bit about super Brownian motion itself. A lot has been discovered about it in the last 15 years or so. There's a lot of different techniques that have been brought to bear on this stochastic process and its close relatives. And the reason you can say quite a bit about this is it's a model with a lot of independence. So if you think about those branching random walks, because of the independence of the particles, if I superimpose two branching random walks on each other, I get a branching random walk back. Okay, there's no particles aren't paying attention to each other, and of course that'll persist in the limit. So we'll call this the additive property. Sum of two super Brownian motions is a super Brownian motion. And so just comparing some properties of Brownian motion with super Brownian motion, there's a well-known connection between Brownian motion and the heat equation and the Dirichlet problem. If you average phi of bt over Brownian paths starting at x, you get a deterministic function, which is just a solution of the heat equation. You can view that either, well, the Gaussian kernel is the fundamental solution, or from a more naive point of view, you can just do a second-order Taylor expansion about t equals 0. And the first order term involves an increment of a Brownian path, which is mean 0, so it disappears. And the second order term gives you exactly this Laplacian. So you can argue from the stochastic from sample paths to see this relationship. Okay, with super Brownian motion and more generally with super processes, you get connections with nonlinear PDEs. So what we do is take a non-negative test function, integrate it with respect to the random measure. You take the negative exponential and you average over super Brownian paths. And if you think of the additive property, if we decompose x0 into a sum of two initial measures, then that produces a decomposition of super Brownian motion into a sum of two independent super Brownian motions. So that produces a product here of two similar objects. So you expect to get a multiplicative dependence in x0. And so you expect this to be a negative exponential of some deterministic function integrated with respect to x0. And if you do a Taylor series expansion of this function, it's a little more involved, but it's just a few lines, what you'll find is this function vt should satisfy this nonlinear partial differential equation, so the branching is giving rise to a negative quadratic term. And so this gives you, for example, a tool of using what's known about solutions to nonlinear PDEs to study qualitative properties of X, and Ionesco, I think, was one of the first people to make effective use of that. But it also gives you a way of representing solutions, in particular solutions to nonlinear boundary value problems, in terms of associated stochastic process. And so this was a problem, a program of Dinkin, Legall, Kuznetsov, recently Mezzalati. And so they can, for example, get some explicit probabilistic representations in terms of boundary value data for nonlinear elliptic problems. Now, the long-term behavior, I guess one of the fundamental things you ask about stochastic processes is equilibrium behavior. As t goes to infinity, what happens to the random system? And for Brownian motion, it's a classic result that in one or two dimensions, Brownian motion is neighborhood recurrent, so it will come back to any little open set infinitely often. In three dimensions or more, it drifts to infinity. With super Brownian motion, it becomes extinct in finite time. So in that sense, you could argue, well, equilibrium behavior is trivial. But if you start with infinite measures, and if you use, because of the additive property, it's completely clear how to extend this to infinite measures. You just start more and more stuff. Start with a multiple of Lebesgue measure, you get this interesting dichotomy. That is, in two and fewer dimensions, if you were to start with Lebesgue measure and look on a finite region on your computer screen, with high probability for large t, you'll see nothing. And that's because locally stuff is dying out, and things are recurrent, so the stuff at infinity can't replenish your computer screen. It tends to stay there. Whereas in three or more dimensions, things are transient, and so there's a steady supply of particles from infinity, which is taking the place of all the stuff that's dying out. So Don Dawson showed that there's a non-trivial equilibrium as t goes to infinity. And for local behavior, Brownian paths are holder 1/2 minus epsilon, so they're rough paths, and that manifests itself fairly easily to see that if you look at the range of a Brownian path up to some fixed time, then that set will be dimension 2 in two or more dimensions, and it'll be a Lebesgue null set, and Taylor and Suzuki and Ray found some exact measure functions for the range. And for super Brownian motion, so we're now talking about the pictures that we were looking on the screen, Don Dawson and Ken Hochberg showed that those objects, again, are two-dimensional and have Lebesgue measure 0 in the plane. So, and the reason the two-dimensional, it's fairly easy to see why this is true. You want to show the Hausdorff dimension is 2, so you have to have a good covering for all those particles on the screen, and that cluster decomposition gives you an effective covering. And that, and then using the Brownian scaling is where the 2 comes from. And more generally, you can show that, in fact, you can recover the random measure from the random set that we were looking at. because the random measure is distributed uniformly on that set according to a deterministic measure. And the deterministic measure is exactly the same measure as for Brownian motion. And the reason for this will come up again later. It's because of the independence and the transience. So if you're in more than three dimensions, and you consider a particle, and the particle, you draw a little ball about a particle, you want to know why are there no non-trivial fluctuations in the local density about particles. And it's because the particle only sees close cousins, individuals that branched off his family tree in the recent past. Because if you're branched off a long way away by the transients, you're going to have left. So if you think about the picture here and the picture there, what you're seeing is a particle backing up and little particles joining them. It's completely independent. So you have complete independence of local density, so the law of large numbers takes over and just gives you triviality. And in two dimensions, of course, there's longer-term recurrence, and the situation is more delicate. And so with Jean-François Lagal, we showed still it's trivial. But we used a beautiful stochastic process introduced by Lagal called the Brownian snake, which is a search process that searches up and down the ancestral lineages of all the particles that ever existed. And this has proved to be an extremely powerful tool in analyzing superprocesses, and also used by Lagal effectively to analyze these nonlinear PDEs. And in one dimension, turns out that then there is a non-trivial density, because you have long-term dependence in the one-dimensional case, and in fact, it's a solution of a stochastic PDE you hope to look at. Yeah, George. So you want to look at the super process where the underlying process is infinite dimensional and see mass coming in. Yeah, but it, you know, is it, it's not going to come rushing in from infinity into a little ball. I mean, the way you get that phenomenon is you try to put more and more mass at infinity. So you start looking at what happens if you have, instead of Lebesgue initial measure, have some initial measures with certain tails, and you do get that. There's a critical rate at which you get explosions. Yeah. For spatial motion, stable motion, yeah. Well, you get propagation everywhere instantaneously. Yeah, that's a good point. I think I proved that, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That, okay. Thanks, Tom. Yeah. So what Tom is saying is that if you look at jump processes, see, one of the nice things Ionesco did here is he used these nonlinear PDEs to show that super Brownian motion propagates at a finite speed, which may not be obvious, but it actually propagates at a nice and very precise finite speed. But if you look at jump processes with kernels, you get instantaneous propagation of support. And so then you get, but that's a phenomenon with finite measures even. Stuff just goes everywhere. Yeah. Okay. So that's the introduction to super processes, and now I thought I'd try to convince you that it's arising in some unsuspected instances. Okay, so I think what I'll do is I'll use the Vohter model as a prototype for this, and then quickly talk about some of the other scaling limit theorems. So the Vohter model was introduced in the mid-70s by Clifford and Sudbury as an invasion model. And so you have two types of particles, say liberals and conservatives, and they're competing with each other. And the dynamics are as follows, that if you're a liberal, then with rate one, you pick a neighboring person in the lattice, and if it's a conservative, you indoctrinate them and they become a liberal. If you're a liberal and you choose a liberal, nothing happens. You've already, there's no point. And of course, the conservatives are doing the same thing to you. So in this setup, we're in a completely symmetric situation. And you could introduce asymmetries to the model, and people have done that in some biological modeling instances. But the thing I want to stress is that we're in the critical case here. And then you rescale time and space just like for Brownian motion. So you scale down the lattice by 1 over square root of n, you speed up time by n, and you record the state of the system in terms of the empirical measure of ones. And I'm going to focus mainly on three or more dimensions, and in that case, it's the same. It's just 1 over n at each site. So one thing to notice is you're in a regime where ones are relatively rare, so they should probably be the conservatives, because the number of sites in the ball of radius 1 is n to the d over 2, and you have n particles. So you're sort of, in biological terms, you're trying to see if a rare type can actually gain a foothold. Okay, so to describe the limit theorem, consider a nearest neighbor random walk. Nearest neighbor refers to the fact that there's nearest neighbor dynamics in the Wöhler model. And three dimensions or more, simple random walk will drift to infinity with probability 1, just like Brownian motion does. And so with some non-trivial positive probability, it will do so without ever returning to the origin. So that's the escape probability. So the theorem with Ted Cox and Rick Durrett is that in two or more dimensions, if your initial configuration of ones settles down, then the probability distribution of the rescaled Wöhler model converges to super Brownian motion. You're in the symmetric case, so of course there's no growth term. Sigma squared reflects the nearest neighbor dynamics, and the branching rate is given by the escape probability. So I guess the question is, well, why does super Brownian motion arise in such interacting particle model? In particular, why do you get that particular branching rate? Okay. And again, it's a universal theorem. You can change the, have an arbitrary kernel being involved here when selecting your neighbors, and you get the same limit, except the microscopic dynamics will affect these two parameters. You just have to adjust these two parameters accordingly. Okay, so to see why it's true, we'll just reinterpret the Wöhler model dynamics to make it look more like a branching random walk. And so we'll suppose that the ones are particles and the zeros are empty space. And Fn0 is just going to be the local density of zeros about x at time t. So this is a random quantity measuring how busy the zeros are around you. And now you die now if you're invaded by a neighboring zero. So each neighboring zero invades you with rate n over 2d. The over 2d is the probability that that neighboring zero chooses you amongst all its neighbors. And then you have to sum over all the invading neighbors, and so the death rate of an individual is just n times the local density of zeros. At the same time, you produce a child if at rate n if you pick a site with a neighboring zero. Otherwise, you're picking a site of the same type and nothing happens. So the probability of picking a site with a neighboring zero is Fn0, so the effective birth rate is n Fn0. So this is exactly the same setup as the branching random walk, except g is zero, but before we had a b here and a b here. We just had some deterministic parameter, and now we've got a random quantity depending on the state. Okay, so what you have to convince yourself is, how do you handle this random quantity, and in particular, how do you show that this random quantity effectively behaves like this escape probability? Okay, so the nice thing about the Wöhler model, which makes it tractable to study, is that it has what's called a coalescing dual random walk. So here's the proof. Looks pretty cruddy. Well, so remember what we're trying to do. We're trying to show that the local density of zero is effectively about a one, is effectively the escape probability. So for starters, you want to show that on average, it's the escape probability. So suppose there's a 1 at x and x prime is a neighboring site. You want to calculate, say, the probability this is a 1. Okay, it's 1 minus the probability it's 0. And reviewing the voter model now is an interactive branch and random walk, so that means particles have histories. Your parent is the most recent particle that imposed its type on you. Right, that becomes a definition of a parent, because that's how ancestral lineages are defined. So you can just trace back the ancestral lineages of these particles, and evidently, so the type of this particle is the type of its ancestor at time zero. And one way you can be sure if you have a type, you'd be sure to get a one here, is if these two ancestral lines have a common ancestor. Because at this point, you know you've got a one, because you've got a one, so then this person must have a one too. Because you've traced back all the people that impose their types on the people that impose their types that impose their types on you. So that says that, okay, if these random walks coalesce, then you know you're going to have a one here. If they don't coalesce, you're just going back and taking your chances at landing on a one. But we're in the regime where the zeros swamp the ones, and so this latter probability is asymptotically zero. So the only way you're really going to get a one is if they coalesce. And if you look at the difference random walk, that's just saying this random walk, the difference random walk, hits zero. So the frequency of neighboring ones is given by the return probability, and the frequency of neighboring zeros is given by the escape probability. Okay, so there's something called a coalescing do, which lets you calculate these things, but the other thing about this picture, it makes it quite clear that if I take a particle y over here and do the same calculation, okay, and if they're macroscopic distance apart, that means in the original lattice they're just miles apart, and they're not going to see each other. So the local frequency of zeros here is completely independent of the local frequencies here in the limit, and so again, the law of large numbers takes over, and what you feel is just this mean effect, escape probability. Okay. So I'll just mention that you prove scaling limit theorems so you can get some new information about the underlying models. So in a seminal paper on the voter model, Maury Bramson and David Griffith asked the following question. They were considering a voter model with a single one. In some sense, this is the basic building block. Looking at it at a large time, and did some first and second moment calculations. Condition that at a large time you still have some ones, the moment calculations they did suggested there should be a scaling limit. So they asked, is there a limiting shape theorem for this set of occupied sites as t goes to infinity? And the point now is that it should be completely obvious from the limit theorem that there is. As you set t equal n and look at the rescaled support of the set of 1s, this is precisely the support of these rescaled voter models. So these are random measures which are converging to super Brownian motion, so this rescaled support should converge to the support of super Brownian motion, conditioned on non-extinction, because he's conditioning on non-extinction. But there's a caveat here, and that is they're not starting n particles, they're starting just a single particle. So what you get, and the limit here is not super Brownian motion, but you're taking one of those clusters that we talked about, because you're conditioning that it's a cluster that survived to one, and what you're looking at here is the support of a single cluster. So in the picture we had green and yellow and black and red, what we're looking at is just the green bit, say. And Bramson, Cox, and Legall prove that, and there's definitely some non-trivial steps in going from the limit theorem to this, but they showed that the rescaled cluster, and so this n0 here is notation for the law of a single cluster as opposed to the whole Brownian motion, is nothing more than support of a cluster conditioned on non-extinction. And these are the things we know quite a bit about, like all those Hausdorff measure results and various polar set calculations. Okay, so what's happened, this was a representative theorem of a number of limit theorems that were proved in the last 5 years, which basically say that in various random systems, near criticality, spatially distributed, if you rescale, In high dimensions, you get super Brownian motion or something closely related. And I'm just going to give a rather too fast survey of this, and you can read this at a more leisurely pace in a very nice survey article of Gord Slade in the Notices of the AMS. So contact processes are another fundamental interacting particle system. It's a epidemic model, and so you have sites on the integer lattice which are infected. They will spread the disease to sites within a certain radius, and at the same time, sites are recovering. And there's a critical rate of spread above which your epidemic can survive forever with positive probability, and below which it dies out. So there's a phase transition, there's a critical parameter, and the theorems are of the following type, that if you examine the system at or near that critical parameter, and you rescale, you get super Brownian motion with certain constant non-trivial parameters. So Rick Durrett and I did this in the long-range case, where the range grows with the scaling. In particular, I should stress that I think Durrett was probably he definitely was the first person to make some conjectures linking super Brownian motion up with particle systems in 1987 for the one-dimensional contact process. And recently, Remco van der Hastedt and Akira Sakai have extended this to the fixed but sufficiently large range using techniques of Slade and his co-authors using the Lace expansion, which I'll say a bit more about. And another class of models, Ted Cox and I recently were analyzing. These were models that arose in mathematical ecology to model competition for resources. And it was interesting because as Claudia Neuhauser and Steve Pakal introduced these models, and one of their original motivations was to show that by introducing spatial components into these ecological models, which are often just sort of some kind of bulk kind of transport model, no space at all. And what they found is that we introduce space, the set of parameter values for which they got coexistence actually shrunk. So it was sort of counterintuitive. And one of the things we were able to do with the limit theorem was to actually gauge exactly how much it shrinks in some near critical regions, albeit in dimensions more than two. And of course, what the biologists are really interested in is two dimensions. So, okay. A different kind of models arise in combinatorics. So again, I'm just going to pick fundamental example, and that's that of lattice trees. So a lattice tree is just it's a tree embedded on the integer lattice. So it's just connected set containing the origin, no cycles, and you allow connections, say, if the lattice points are a certain L infinity distance apart. So there's a certain maximal L infinity distance apart. And if you look at all lattice trees with a fixed number of nodes, say with n squared vertices, then there's a finite collection. You give each one equal probability. So now you have a random lattice tree. And then you rescale it by 1 over root n, so this same 1 over root n scaling. And you look at the uniform probability on that rescaled tree. So each vertex gets probability 1 over n squared. So that gives you a random probability. And David Aldous, in his work on continuum random trees, conjectured that that random probability should converge to something he called integrated super excursion. So Eric Derbez and Gord Slade proved Aldous's conjecture in the dimensions that he conjectured it, namely d bigger than 8, and L, this length, sufficiently large. And so what they showed is that if IN is this random measure in this rescaled, randomly picked lattice tree, now that converges to the following object. So this is one way of describing ISE. So you're looking at a cluster starting at the origin, so look at a single cluster, and you integrate that measure over time. It has some finite lifetime. You integrate it all the way on that lifetime, and that gives you a random measure on RD. and you condition it to be a probability measure. Okay, so that's the definition of IFE. It probably is a little more transparent if you think of how Aldous constructed IFE, namely as a limit of progeny in the Galton-Watson branching process. So I claim that it's pretty easy to see these are the same things. What we're doing here is you start an individual and they do Galton-Watson branching with the usual scaling of their offspring, and then you look at the tree of all the progeny that ever existed, so one of those little clusters that I drew at the beginning, and then you put equal mass at, and it's probably better to do this discrete time branching rather than continuous time, so 1 over n, 2 over n, 3 over n, you're having a discrete time branching process, and you look at all the progeny that ever existed and you put equal mass at each site. Okay, and that's, so you put mass 1 over n squared at each site. And then if you condition that this is a probability measure, that's what this is doing, that the total number of progeny that ever existed is n squared, you get the limit ISE, and it's not hard to see because, you know, 1 over n goes with this sum, that produces a Riemann sum that goes with a time integral, and the other 1 over n is just your super Brownian mass scaling. Okay, and it's true in dimension bigger than 8, and the reason is that if this is to be true, then super Brownian motion should be a tree. That is, if you look at the range of the particles swept out by super Brownian motion, there shouldn't be any cycles. And that's true if and only if d is bigger than or equal to 8. And again, this follows from the fact that if we look at the range of all the supports, support at a fixed time is dimension 2, but if you glue them all together, you can use those cluster arguments to show that the dimension will be 4. So if you think of dividing super Brownian motion to two little pieces, two four-dimensional objects will miss each other in 8 dimensions. So there won't be any loops in the range. Okay, so things are sparse enough in eight or more dimensions that there's no loops, and so that means there's a hope that these lattice trees will converge to integrated super excursion. And what it says basically is, of course, you know, there's a little repulsive interaction locally. Galton-Watson trees are going to overlap locally. There's no question, but in the big scale they don't. And so what happens is these lattice trees have built-in repulsive interactions, but they're all very local. Once they get apart, they don't want to intersect anymore. So the sort of rough idea is that, again, you have this local interaction happening everywhere, and in the limit, you just see some funny numbers coming out in your ISE process. Okay. So there's a number of other... And the proofs here use the Lace expansion. So this is this method of Bridges and Spencer doing inclusion-exclusion. And they calculate moments explicitly and show that you get these limiting moments in the limit. And it's a remarkable piece of work. And Gord and Remco have been, and Frank and Hollander have been refining this tool. And so, for example, Gord and Takashihara have made substantial progress on showing that the scaling limit of critical percolation, the incipient infinite cluster and critical percolation above 6 dimensions should converge to ISE as well. I guess the class, I did want to say something about population genetic models, but I think I asked Ken if I could take 2 hours, and he assured me this was not an option. So, but just to say something quickly here. In population genetics, there's a class of processes called Fleming-Vio processes, which model distribution of allele types in a population. So instead of sort of migrating in space, you think of the space now as being a space of allele types. And the migration now becomes mutation. The type of an offspring may differ from the type of its parent. And instead of branching, you have sampling from the gene pool. So the main difference here is the population has some finite carrying capacity. So the population size is fixed, capital N. And if you look at the empirical distribution of genotypes and take the large population limit, and there's nothing again special about this sort of random walk dynamics, you could have different kinds of mutation dynamics, you get a super process, you get a Fleming-Vio process in the limit. And Allison Etheridge and Peter March showed that this Fleming-Vio process can be constructed from a super process, in this case super Brownian motion, in the simplest possible way. Super Brownian motion has, you know, random total population size. Fleming-Vio has population size 1. It's normalized. You just condition to be total population 1, you get Fleming-Vio. There's a very nice proof of that by, well, heuristic proof, but, well. I wanted to say something about stochastic PDEs, so. Okay. So if you suppose for the moment that super Brownian motion has a density, then the claim is that density is the unique solution of the stochastic partial differential equation. So this these terms, first few terms are fairly obvious. You have some diffusion going on, you have a growth term, and then you have a stochastic term here coming from the branching. So the W dot here is space-time white noise, so that means that heuristically if I look at all these increments over space-time, that those are IID normal random variables with mean zero and variance the area of the space-time rectangle. And in one dimension, this is completely true. Mark Reimers and Kono and Shiga showed this equation has a unique solution, and the solution is the density of super Brownian motion. Now, in more than one dimension, we already mentioned that there isn't a density, so xt is a singular measure. But one can interpret these equations in a generalized sense. So you can multiply by a test function and make sense out of this stochastic term when you integrate it out. And if you do that, then solutions exist. They're now random measures. They're unique, and they're just super Brownian motion. So this kind of characterization is what's used, for example, in the proof of the Vogler model convergence. You need a reasonable characterization. You explicitly show it converges to this object. So one thing that arises is, why do you get the square root coming in here? It's a natural question, and it's going to create a pain for us. The additive property of super Brownian motion says that if I add two independent solutions of this equation, I should get a solution of that equation back. And of course, these terms are linear, so they don't pose a problem. So we just have to analyze two independent stochastic terms here. So you have W1 and W2, they're Gaussian, and this sum should look like this, because X1 plus X2 should be a solution. Okay, so this is the scaling relationship that characterizes Gaussian distribution, right? The only difference is, in our scaling relationship, we had C1 and C2 constants, but you can condition on information up to time t. The space-time white noises are retreating into the future. So the square root function is forced upon you by that additive property. Okay, and the problem with square root function is that it's not Lipschitz and it's not, and it's degenerate. So it creates a number of difficulties. And well, in the previous limit theorems, the only one that I really dealt with in some depth is the Vogler model. We had local interactions, that is, you couldn't give birth onto sites which were already a 1. This produced some local interactions, but in the scaling limit, these things became independent, and you just got a constant parameter entering in the limit. But it's easy to think of various interactions which that's not going to work. I mean, if particles are attracted to each other, if they repulse, if the branching rate depends on what your population in a neighborhood looks like, those are going to produce long-range interactions that will persist in the limit. And a number of them, particular cases, have been studied in detail. But I wanted just to try to introduce a class of interactions which will produce local super Brownian motions. And it's motivated by Ito's integral equation. So introduces stochastic integral equation driven by Brownian motion to construct a diffusion which behaves locally like a Brownian motion but with state-dependent parameters. And Don Dawson, in a lecture I remember at Cornell in 87, gave a very nice motivation in using super Brownian motion in a number of different ways to try to construct interactive measure value diffusions. And this is a natural equation. You just, you know, replace all the constant parameters that appear over here with state-dependent parameters. So you, a particle at x will branch in a population xt at a certain rate. A particle at x in a population xt will have a certain diffusion matrix and drift. And so the first kind of question you ask is, do these equations have unique solutions, and are there some techniques which help you analyze it? And existence is straightforward. You just take the branching particle system which suggests the equation, and all limit points will satisfy the equation. And the first non-trivial problem you run into is uniqueness. It's infinite dimensional. You have this, you know, you have to interpret solutions in a generalized sense, but most problematic is the fact you have this degenerate non-Lipschitz coefficient in front of the white noise. And Don Dawson in 77 introduced a change of measure technique which showed that solutions with this drift here are absolutely continuous with respect to solutions without the drift, and gave a Radon-Nikodym derivative. So that allows you to reduce the problem to g equals zero. And about 10 years ago, I introduced some techniques which allowed you to handle the spatial interactions. And basically, the idea here was to write down an Itô equation along a Brownian tree. So you have this tree of historical, you know, genealogies of all the particles in the population. You just solve Itô equations up and down those trees. And Tom Kurtz and Peter Donnelly were able to incorporate that into some particle systems they introduced called lookdowns, which again arose out of work of Don Dawson and Ken Hochberg. And together they showed that these solutions are well posed, and they also gave some techniques to analyze them. So what I wanted to focus on was the case which is still open. And so that's the branching case. So in those models that we took B to be constant, or it could depend on location, but it couldn't be state dependent. And well, what we decided to do was to at least analyze this problem in finitely many dimensions. And it turns out that even in finite dimensions, this was a non-trivial problem. So superprocesses, you could have any state space. It doesn't have to be RD. And so take a state space that's finite. It's got k points. So that means instead of having a measure in RD, you have a vector in the first the positive orthant, where xi is just the mass at I, and your underlying particles before you take the limit are just Markov chains on k states. So all you have are jump rates. And it could be state-dependent jump rates, so your generators, instead of diffusion-type generators, you're just jumping from I to j at some rate, which could depend on the mass at all the vertices. And then this interactive stochastic PDE just becomes an ordinary stochastic differential equation. So instead of having a space-time white noise, you have a finite collection of Brownian motions. And the question is, does this SDE have a unique solution? And more generally, you can, you know, replace this drift by some function DI. And you put minimal conditions on this. I mean, assume the DIs and the BIs are continuous. We want the solutions to stay in the positive orthant. So if xi is 0, this term here should be bigger than or equal to 0. So this condition is natural. And this condition is, in some instances, something you wouldn't like to assume, namely there's no further degeneracy, but let's do that. And so the problem with this is that it's a degenerate diffusion, so the Struk-Verdan conditions aren't satisfied, and it's non-Lipschitz, so Itô uniqueness doesn't hold. And in fact, uniqueness is false. So here's a simple one-dimensional counterexample. one-dimensional diffusions. We're really retreating now. And it's just, you know, one-dimensional diffusions in the positive half-line is a complete theory. Sellars got a complete classification for boundary value behavior. And if this constant is bigger than 1, 0 is a regular boundary point. And what that means is you can start at 0, enter, and spend no time at 0. This drift here is sharp enough to kind of push you in. And, of course, 0 is also a solution. So, and there's all kinds of other solutions which can have sticky boundary behavior. So the have to avoid this counterexample in coming up with the theorem. So here's some recent work with Rich Bass, Siva III, and Martin Barlow. Okay, so we're looking at, you know, finite dimensional diffusion theory now, degenerate diffusions. And so if you strengthen the condition here so that you're strictly positive when you hit 0, so you get a non-trivial push, obviously here that when you hit 0, this term is 0, then there's a unique and law solution. And this condition is unfortunately not, it is satisfied in certain equations that arise in the work of Dawson and Graven on hierarchical mean field rescaling, so there was some interest in it, but it, if you think of the most simple kind of QIJs, so we're now talking about processes moving around on finitely many sites, if you just do nearest neighbor random walk on the circle, then this condition won't be satisfied, because what's determining your drift? Well, it's you're getting stuff coming in from your neighboring sites, and if your neighboring sites happen to be empty and you're empty, your drift will be 0. So this was a troubling condition, but obviously you have to assume something. So Rich Bass and I showed that, okay, you can drop this condition, allowing nearest neighbor interactions, if you assume holder continuity of the coefficients. So again, of course, that gets rid of this logarithmic singularity. And the methods here are analytic. It's trying to push through Shatter-type estimates or Struk-Varadan-type estimates for degenerate diffusion coefficients. So in the end, it relies, you think of these operators as perturbation of appropriate constant coefficient degenerate operator, and you have to get estimates on the derivatives of the resolvent. So in the end, you end up just mucking around with eigenfunctions or series expansions. And the, well, there's some non-trivial points here. We're able to do this by working with L2. And the hard part of Struk-Varadan perturbation theory is the LP theory, and somehow we were able to, well, we were able to avoid it using sort of Krylov-Zavanoff type estimates. And part B was perhaps more interesting, I think more promising, because what we found there is the estimates we got on some weighted holder space were actually independent of dimension. So when you have estimates in an independent dimension, that means you could push through these results to countably infinite systems of Markov chains. So you can do super processes now with countable state space. And in some sense, there's really only countable particles around doing this super process. So there was some feeling, and we still are optimistic, but there's obviously some problems, that we should be able to push through this to try to analyze this equation.